This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today we are recording in our studios before a live audience of friends of the ETV Endowment. And our guest is Bill Owen, who's been in broadcasting for quite some time. And we're going to be talking about a number of his books, which deal with old-time radio and television, early television. He's also done some interesting things for those of us who are over 60. Bill Owen's the Over 60 Trivia Guide. And then he also has top 10 listings about who are the best child stars, what was the best radio show, and all sorts of things that will generate, I think, a conversation. He's also a graduate of the other USC, you know, the one all the way to the other coast. So, Bill, welcome to the Journal.
Well, my wife always reminded me that this USC, was founded long before University of Southern California.
Oh, absolutely.
But we were talking about things that happen accidentally, like the invention of the X-ray, the invention of Scotch tape. They always have their own stories. And my interest in radio started accidentally. I was an announcer on a television show called Discovery at ABC back in the early 60s. And the host of the show, Frank Buxton, he and I used to, during many breaks that occurred during a television taping, would just discuss the old days of radio. And one day we got into a discussion of who played such and such a role, like the Shadow or the Lone Ranger, and we didn't agree on it. So I said, well, I'll look it up tomorrow. So I went to the famous Great New York Library on Fifth Avenue, the two lions in front, Patience and Fortitude, one of the most famous libraries in the world, and went in and asked for their books on old-time radio. She came back a minute later, said, there aren't any. I said, what do you mean there are no books? We have some individuals like Bob Hope, Walter Winchell, with their own versions of their careers. Nobody had ever sat down and recorded what had happened. And so I said, well, it's up to us, I guess. So I felt like I had a mission to bring back the memories of old-time radio. And we decided we'd have a little pamphlet, The Top Stars. That little pamphlet grew into this 300-and-some-page book, and it has the cast list, the openings. It's all the memories of old-time radio. And it came along at a fortunate time for us, Walter, because most of the stars who had retired and so on were getting up in years, and I was able to get on the phone, no email in those days, get on the phone or write letters and get as much information, pick their brain, so to speak, and get all the information. And fortunately, if somebody tried to do it today, it'd be a little too late for it. Some of the openings, for example, I would consider a literature almost. Like somebody in the audience here a moment ago asked about the Lone Ranger. And listen to how brilliantly this is written. With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again. That is not just an opening to a program. That is literature.
You know, I'm looking at things like that, but you've got who the announcers were, who did the special effects. Since there was no general source, how did you dig all this stuff up?
I just had to go to the actors, and the actors turns out to be not the best source. They would usually say the writers and directors, they're the people who'd remember. For example, a man named Bud Collier, he played about 12 different roles, including the voice of Superman. He was a host of game shows. He was on soap operas. And he had so many things in his mind, he couldn't remember one show from another. But if he went to the writer or the director, and they often had actual scripts they would send to me, that was my source. A perfect example, there was a show called Wendy Warren and the News, a unique program, a soap opera. It came on CBS radio.
When was that? Because I don't...
Well, this would have been in the late 40s.
Okay.
Wendy Warren and the News. And it was interesting because they would open with Douglas Edwards of CBS doing a serious newscast. If you tuned in at that moment, you'd say it was just a newscast. And then you would hear, okay, that finishes it. Okay. And he'd had the other woman, Wendy Warren, gave women's features. And they would sign off the program. And then they went into the soap opera story. It was such a unique feature. So I talked to her on the telephone, and I said, Miss Freeman, you did a show called Wendy Warren and the News. big show for many, many years. She turned to her husband on the phone and said, did I do a show called Wendy Warren? And he said, yes, honey, you were that for 12, 15 years. So that was the sense of the actors not knowing everything. But one of the people I interviewed was named Thomas Cowan. He was one of the earliest of all the radio announcers. And he described radio perfectly. He said there was an explosion of sound. Up until then, the world was a quiet place. Occasional trolley car, maybe, Bell, or a rattly old jalopy going by. But when radio came in the late 20s, it was an explosion of sound. How can you capture it better than that? And he explained how the early announcers didn't give their names, like Don Wilson and Ken Carpenter and Harlow Wilcox. The famous announcers give their own names. They gave themselves a code name, and he was ACN. A meant he was an announcer. C was his name, Cowan, and N was his origin point, was Newark, New Jersey. So if you heard a program on your crystal radio set back in the 20s, he would say, this is ACN reporting. This is the sense of mission I have to let people know. I don't ever want the thoughts of old-time radio to die. It was such a chapter in our history, and it was something that we assumed at the time would be forever. And then this ugly television came along, and it was gone.
Well, you mentioned New Jersey. I just had the picture that everybody was either in a studio in New York or L.A., and, you know, they did Front Page Farrell, and then 15 minutes later, they did One Man's Family.
Right.
But that's not the case. They were broadcasting from all over the country?
All over. One of them was Detroit was a great origination point. They had three programs there, WXYZ, which still exists in Detroit. They had the Lone Ranger. They had Sergeant Preston of the Yukon.
Oh, wow, yes.
Yeah.
He used to come on late in the afternoon.
Right, and the Green Hornet. Well, they would use the same cast members. The same announcer, Fred Foy, did all three shows, for example. And he told me a great story one time. I think you'll get a kick out of our studio audience. By the way, I have to back up. Studio audiences weren't common at the beginning. It would go into a quiet room, and the comedians didn't like it because there was no response from the audience. And Eddie Cantor said, I can't work this way. So he said he invited some of his friends in. From that moment on, they would always try to fill the studios with a couple hundred people to get the audience reaction. But anyway, this happened on Sergeant Preston. And if you picture the script, first they did the regular live broadcast, and then they would do it again live for the West Coast. You've heard that. Once again for the West Coast is an old expression.
Well, see, growing up in the Southeast, that was not a—
You wouldn't be aware of it.
We didn't get that.
Right. Well, anyway, on the script, it turns out that this prospector was up in the Arctic tundra, and he had been captured by some bad guys, and he was tied to a stake, and he was going to perish in the tundra. When along came a pack of wolves led by this ferocious-looking she-wolf. But earlier, it seems, that he had rescued a she-wolf, and he looked up in the eyes, and he said, I saw the she-wolf, her eyes, her hair, her fangs. That's my wolf. And it was very exciting. He was so, and it went really well. Everybody in the studio thought, okay, now time for the West Coast version. Didn't go quite as well. He came to the scene. He says, I looked up. I saw the she-wolf, those eyes, that hair, those fangs. That's my wife. What happened was the studio actors could not continue. They were on the floor in stitches, and they always kept an organist handy. And the organist came in and finished out the half hour. So the disastrous things happened. Frank Singheiser had a terrible thing happen to him. I really sympathize with him because I never appreciated jokes. Sometimes they'd come up and light your script while you're on the air and do obnoxious things to get your attention. Frank Singheiser of NBC and Mutual prided himself on reading his scripts cold. In other words, no rehearsal. Most people come in and read over it and mark it. No, not Frank. He would come in, and he'd read his script, and he'd go through it, always flawlessly. One day they got him. He turned the page. He said, Chiang Kai-shek today said. It was all Chinese writing, the whole script. He was so furious. He somehow bumbled through it, but he wasn't happy about it.
Well, this almost sounds like stand-up comedy improv, whether it's drama or not. You know, today I'm playing Sergeant Preston, and the next 30 minutes I'm doing somebody else. Now, you say 30 minutes. I just remember most of these shows, particularly in the daytime, were 15 minutes.
Daytime was generally 15, and there were very few hour shows. There were just a handful of them. But even Jack Benny was a half hour.
The Breakfast Club.
Oh, that was an hour.
I know. Don McNeil's Breakfast Club.
That was one of those shows that was, it was always on in our house, but nobody seemed to pay attention to it. It was just kind of background.
I was going to say the same thing, but they did go on the road, and they did come to Mobile, Alabama, played in the Big Sanger Theater.
Yeah.
But we were watching, I guess I was about 8 or 9. It was time to march around the table. I thought, we can't. It was just the people on the stage who got up and marched around to the, to the music and then sat back down, and then McNeil came back on the air.
Here was the song went, "Good morning, Breakfast Clubbers. Good morning to you. We got up bright and early just to howdy do you." And then they did the march around the table, as you said, and they had the morning prayer, each in his own words, each in his own way. And it was a popular show for you. I was involved indirectly to it because when I left WLW in Cincinnati as a staff announcer, I got an opportunity to go to ABC in New York, and I gave my 2 weeks' notice, and I went in to tell him about it, and he said, "Oh, they're always stealing our announcers here from Cincinnati." He said, "That's not right. You got to give me 2 weeks." I said, "I'm giving you 2 weeks." He said, "Oh, well, I know. We'll cancel the Breakfast Club." That was very important to have the affiliates, so I was indirectly responsible for having the Breakfast Club canceled in Cincinnati. But your memory is very good about the march around the breakfast table.
Well, the other hour show that I remember was early Saturday morning was Big John and Sparky.
Oh, yes, yes.
The Teddy Bear's Picnic.
Yeah, that was
very... If you go down to the woods today.
That was one of the few shows that survived past 1950 and kept on going.
I can remember as kids in the neighborhood, about maybe 8 or maybe 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, 4 or 5 of us would be gathered around listening for Big John and Sparky.
One of the best shows of all. Well, there were a lot of kiddie shows, too. Let's Pretend was very, very famous. A lot of people aren't aware of what they called block programming. And now you know what block programming was. Generally speaking, in the early afternoon, we'd call the soap operas named because they had so many soap sponsors, of course. And that was for the ladies. Then in mid-afternoon would start programs for the pre-K kids. Popeye, we'll say, Mickey Mouse on the air, and so on. And then around 3:30 or 4 would start the children's adventures, like Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. To this day, a lot of people can remember who the sponsor was of Jack Armstrong. If I talk to an audience, they'll shout out, "Wheaties!" They remember all these years. And Little Orphan Annie, one of my favorites. Oh, this happened to me. Little Orphan Annie used to come on with his announcer, Pierre Andre, came out of Chicago. You mentioned it came from different parts around the country. And he would come on at the end of the show and say, "We've got a special secret message for you." But you had to have a code card to decode that wonderful message, really important message. And so we felt deprived because we couldn't decode it. So I asked my dad if I could get an Ovaltine label and a dime to get one. He's a dime, you know, in the Depression, you don't hand out dimes regularly. We wheedled and coaxed, and finally my dad gave me a dime, and we got a lot of Ovaltine labels and sent it in. We waited the traditional 6 weeks, and the announcer is just coming on the air that as the postman comes up the driveway, and there's Little Orphan Annie's picture on the upper left. Oh, wow, this is exciting. We're going to be able to decode it. So we all set, listening. Pierre Andre says, "Boys and girls of America, I have some terrible news for you today. A gang of international spies has intercepted our code, and we need to get a new one. So ask your dad for a dime and an oval." We tore up the card. Never did find out what that wonderful message was. Things like that would happen. The biggest program of all for premiums was Tom Mix and the Ralston Straight Shooters, I think they called them.
Bill, you were talking about blocks and the women's soap operas and then the little kids and then getting into the older kids, and most of the shows except for Little Orphan Annie seem to be designed towards little boys. Get your Red Ryder BB gun.
Oh, yeah.
But there were things like, I guess by 5:36, Front Page Feral. I don't know why that one sticks to my mind because it was kind of an adult adventure story. He was always getting
into newspaper man.
Newspaper man.
Richard Widmark was one of the actors on that, the early ones.
But he was always getting into trouble. Of course, later in the evening, you got things like The Scarlet Pimpernel.
Yes. Serious drama.
My brother and I shared a bedroom, and he could listen to it. I think it came on about 8:30 or something.
Well, the block programming continued, as you say, and NBC would have Monday night would be music night. And they have the City Service Concert of the Air, The Voice of Firestone, The Telephone Hour. Tuesday was my favorite night on NBC because they had the lineup of Bob Hope, followed by Red Skelton, one program after another, just incredible. That was the beauty of radio. At any hour of the day, you got supreme entertainment. And there were usually, if you're in a metropolitan area, you had your choice of six or eight stations or maybe more.
And people forget that that time there was a mutual network, so there really were four.
Actually, a fifth came along, all sports, called the Liberty Broadcasting System, which came out of Texas, and they recreated baseball games. One of my favorite programs, there was a gospel singer, he'll go unnamed for obvious reasons, but he used to come on Saturday mornings, and he would sing these wonderful old hymns. And people, you know, just crazy about him. He had one little problem. He was a little heavy on the sauce at times. Sometimes they'd even carried over from Friday night, and Saturday morning he'd come in, and the producer would kind of wonder, I hope he makes it through. And each week, you know, it got worse and worse. One week he came in totally sloshed, and they said, he's not going to get through with this. But he started a hymn, and he just couldn't finish it. He was gone. And they said, this is the end of his career. What a wonderful person. Nope. People wrote in such letters. They said, it was so wonderful how he got carried away by those hymns that he couldn't even finish. His career got even bigger.
Oh, the Grand Ole Opry was on?
Grand Ole Opry, yeah. And there was an equivalent on NBC called the National Barn Dance, in which little Georgie Gobel was a 12-year-old singer. And he started his comedy career there.
I'm just curious about the technology. You say things are coming out of Detroit, Chicago, New York. How did it get broadcast nationally? Did it go to one central location and then rebroadcast
well,
out?
Well, the network started like this. If you hit the notes GEC over there, you'll hear bong, 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 which was that was the General Electric. That stood for GEC, GEC. And they hooked up WGY Schenectady, New York, with a big station in New York City. And that was the first network. So that was the first time anybody had two stations together. And they got the idea to expand. And then CBS came along. And then the upstart was ABC, which I later joined. ABC started as a result of NBC having two networks, the blue and the red. And they had separate programming. Occasionally, they would get together for bulletins, have the same programming. They were always listed separately, and the program guide would always say, blue or red network, NBC blue. And this led to problems. One of the announcers one time went in the studio, and they always had his script there ready for him. And all he had to do was say, this is the NBC blue network, and it would have it in parentheses. This is the NBC blue or red. So one time, he went in and said, this is the NBC blue or I don't know which one this is. But even worse, Hal Perry, who later became the great Gildersleeve on radio, he came in one time, and he was a staff announcer in San Francisco on NBC. On one network, the Pope was delivering a very important speech, Pope Pius XII, pre-World War II. And it was people wanted to know what he has to say about the war effort. In the other studio was a comedy pair, just silly hijinks, just doing crazy stuff. And he got into the wrong studio, and he was supposed to sign off Bob and Ray type thing. And he was in the studio where the Pope had just finished this important address. And he walked in and said, this silly bit of nonsense came to you from San Francisco. They said every Catholic in San Francisco was out to get him. But mistakes did happen over the years, that's for sure.
And those, they weren't bleeped out. They went out.
They went out. There was no coming back. That was the beauty of live audiences, live participations. I want to ask you about the Grand Central Station, if you remember that one. And that had one of the most famous openings of all. You have to be a certain number of years of age in order to remember it, but I remember it very, very well. It was a series of dramatic sketches, and it would always be under this title of the Grand Central Station. And here's the most, one of the most famous openings ever. So let me read this one paragraph to you. You hear the train pulling into the station, and the announcer says, "As a bullet seeks its target, shining rails in every part of our great country are aimed at Grand Central Station, heart of the nation's greatest city. Drawn by the magnetic force of the fantastic metropolis, day and night great trains rush toward the Hudson River, sweep down its eastern bank for 140 miles, flash briefly by the long red row of tenement houses south of 125th Street, dive with a roar into the 2.5-mile tunnel which burrows beneath the glitter and swank of Park Avenue, and then," and you hear this escaping steam, and then he says, "Crossroad of a million private lives, Grand Central Station." Well, there's a footnote to that. All the stations, they didn't always have steam trains. They eventually replaced by electric. At the time this was going on, they were all electric trains, which reminds me of another interesting program called First Nighter, very similar. And the famous line there was, "Smoking in the outer lobby only, please." But First Nighter, the announcer would say, "Comes to you from the little theater off Times Square." Well, it was a long way off Times Square. It came from Chicago.
Well, looking right here in this part of the book, The Great Gildersleeve.
Oh, Leroy, my boy. Remember he would say that? He had this pestiferous little nephew that always gave him trouble. Leroy.
Didn't he come out of Fibber McGee? And
he was one of the first spinoffs in the history of radio, which became common. And another character came out of there called Beulah. Beulah was made on Fibber McGee, and she had her own program. But it was always shocking, but she was a black maid on the program, and she was portrayed by a white man. And that caused a little bit of social disturbance eventually, as in the case of Amos and Andy.
Fibber McGee and Molly and Fibber McGee's closet.
Oh.
You know, I can remember my grandmother saying, "If you don't clean up, it's going to be like your closet is going to be like Fibber McGee's. You open the door and everything's going to..."
I was interviewed by a man in Montreal several years ago about that. And when I explained that to him, he said, "That's what my mother meant about your room looks like Fibber McGee." He didn't have any idea what she meant about that. But it was anticipated by the audience, and they'd have been so disappointed. You'd wonder, well, how do they do the same thing week after week after week? It didn't bore people. They looked forward to it.
Yeah, something always came tumbling down.
Yeah, and with a little tinkly bell at the end.
Yeah. Folks, we need to pause for a minute and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Bill Owen about his career in broadcasting, radio broadcasting, and about the golden age of radio. So, Bill, let's get back to you. You went to USC, and did you go into showbiz?
I was actually a pre-med student at Southern Cal, and my mother wanted a doctor in the family. She never did get one because midway through, about my junior year, I started working for the local radio station, and it just seemed like a perfect marriage for me. That I didn't really enjoy comparative anatomy and dissecting cats. It wasn't my calling, even though my mother insisted you got to have a doctor in the family. So I gradually shifted, and I remember she went around to some of the professors, "Can you talk Bill out of shifting his major?" And they said, "Yeah, he should stick with it and just do radio on the side." But you can't really have a career on the side. They call you for an audition. You can't say, "Well, I'm in lab tomorrow. I can't come over." So I drifted into that, and against all advice, and switched over, and I started broadcasting sporting events at Southern Cal. Broadcast from the Coliseum, and I did baseball games. And one of my experiences doing baseball, I was broadcasting for the American Forces Network in Europe, and I was all alone. I had a little black box, and I plugged it in, the telephone jack, and I had no engineer or director to help me. And I was sitting up very high. And for a baseball broadcaster, his scorecard is his Bible. He's got to have it. And I had made all these notes. I'm in the middle of the game, broadcast, and all of a sudden a swirl of wind took it, and there it goes floating. Oh, it's gone. And it's down three stories down in a puddle of mud. So I told the audience, I said, "I have two choices. I can fake it. I just lost my scorecard. Or you can sit here and wait for me. I'll be back in about a minute and a half," and resume the game. And I went down and got all this dead air, came back, and resumed the game, and I was able to control it. Then I started thinking, the boss is not going to like this. So I got back to the station. Fortunately, he thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard.
Well, of course, that today is the great crime, is to have any dead air at all.
Yeah, 2 seconds is bad.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You mentioned the shadow a few minutes ago, too, and I came along too late
knows.
To do the shadow, but I've always wanted to. So may I have a bit of my career on your program? Okay, you have to use your imagination now, but the announcer comes on after that wonderful music, the shadow. Mysterious character who aids the forces of law and order is in reality Lamont Cranston, wealthy young man about town. And then the shadow's voice comes in and says, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows. I always wanted to do that. Thank you, Walter.
But did you actually, you started out in broadcasting, did you do any of these shows? Did you do any of that characterization?
These shows were pretty much gone by the time I came along. I got started after service and everything. So by then it's the early 50s, and radio had been pretty much replaced by television. It was kind of in the basement of all the big stations. So I missed out on doing it, but what I did have a thrill of was being picked to be an announcer at ABC, which I spent 30 years as a staff announcer. And I was 29 years old starting out. And my colleagues were all these veteran announcers I'd grown up with. Milton Cross, for example, the Metropolitan Opera announcer. Some of you may remember that name. And I couldn't believe that he was my colleague. I'm his peer. It's just hard to accept. And I said, well, Mr. Cross, it's so nice to know you. He said, Bill, you can call me Milt. I said, okay, Mr. Cross. I couldn't get it out.
Well, I'm looking at this wonderful book, that your first book, The Big Broadcast, 1920 to 1950. And there are hundreds, maybe even over 1,000 different shows in here.
It's just amazing how many there are.
How long did it take you to put this book together?
Well, that was about a 3-year project. I spent many, many hours at the New York Public Library going through the old radio magazines, Radio Guide, Radio Mirror. I went through Variety. Everything was on microfilm at that point. So I went through miles of microfilm and getting all this information. And then I'm on the telephone, and there were two of us working at the same time. And we just had all this tremendous material. And then we said, what do we do with it? And we had to figure out a format to put it in. And we would discuss, should we do it in the form of comedies in one section, dramas, music? No, because there's programs that were both comedy and drama and so on. So we just put it down as an alphabetical listing. So if you want Jack Benny, you go for J, Jack Benny. And, of course, he's probably the most famous of all the comedians. And he had that wonderful family of his wife, Mary Livingston, who was a hilarious comedian, and the announcer Don Wilson, Phil Harris, Dennis Day. And Mel Blanc added so much. Mel Blanc used to be the train conductor, and he always say, Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga. He put Cucamonga on the map with that little bit. And, of course, Jack Benny, you remember his age. To this day, everybody remembers he was 39.
And his violin.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mel Blanc also was the violin teacher on that program.
Well, Mel Blanc was also doing voices for movies. He did all of that.
Oh yeah, yeah. There were so many great comedians in those days. Jimmy Durante, ink-a-dink-a-doo. Jimmy would say, "I'm ready for Broadway, but is Broadway ready for me?" Or he might say, "I haven't slept for days and days. It's a good thing I sleep at night." And Bob Hope, I remember he had a character called Jerry Colonna, with a big mustache, and he was famous. And one time he talked to Colonna on the phone. He says, "Colonna, what are you doing?" "Hope, I'm building a bridge from New York to London." "Colonna, you can't build a bridge from New York to London." "You can't? Tear it down, fellas." that was the type of, or Red Skelton with Deadeye, the cowboy. I remember one time he had a trained horse he was so proud of, and he said, "Come on, boy, I want to show how smart you are. What's 1 plus 1? So the horse goes, come on, boy, one more. He couldn't count himself. But Eddie Cantor, we mentioned him before. He had a character called the Mad Russian. How do you do? The characters were just so wonderful in those days.
Well, you did the knock for the horse. Sound effects were an important part of the radio show.
Oh, that's so important. If you wanted a horse, you took two coconut half shells, bang them together, galloping. If you wanted a roaring fire, you take a piece of cellophane and crinkle it by the microphone. It sounded just like a fire. Sometimes the sound effects were better than the real thing. For example, I interviewed Frankie Lane and talked about his famous song Mule Train, in which they have a whip lashing in the middle of the song. Mule train, get along, get along. And I said, was that a real whip, Frankie? He said, no, they tried a real whip, and it didn't sound like a whip. They took two two-by-fours and went like that, and that was the whip. So it was. They used to have tours at NBC in New York where you could see the actual sound effects being made. That was almost, for the people who did the sound effects, an art. Mm-hmm. It was not easy. One of my favorites was on a CBS radio program one time when they had a little bit of a failure. And in the scene, the bad guy says, okay, you dirty rat, I'm going to shoot you because of that. Here's my gun. And the thing jammed. It wouldn't go off. He had blanks, but it wouldn't go off. So he thought real fast, and he said, all right, I can't shoot you. My gun's jammed. I'm going to stab you instead. Just then the gun goes off. So they had a lot of embarrassing moments like that over the years.
You know, I've seen pictures of, let's say there are four or five characters. They're all standing right side by side.
Right.
Five different microphones.
Right, yeah.
Usually holding a script in their hand.
I've got pictures on the book of people like that, yeah. It was incredible. But one of the most embarrassing things of all actually did not happen. This is legendary. A man called Uncle Don used to do a children's program, and he was kind of a feisty guy, and he used to take chances. He'd say things when the mic was off that he shouldn't say and so on. He'd joke about it. One day, supposedly, after he signed off the program, he said, that'll hold a little, the word starts with B. It was not actually an event that happened. People to this day say they heard him say it. It's become so legendary, so apocryphal, that he's had that reputation. But they said he actually ruined his career because people believed he did say it. So things like that happened. That happened to me one time on a television program. I played a cowboy for a short time out in the Midwest, and interviewing kids like Art Linkletter used to do on television. And I'd say, all right, little boy, what can I do for you today on the program? He says, I have to go to the bathroom. You have to learn to cover real fast. And another boy said, Marshal Bill, are those real six-shooters? I said, no, they're just toy cap guns. And I saw the crestfallen look on his face. I just had broken his heart. So I said, next time that happens, and I knew it would, I'm ready. So I would say, no, Marshal Bill's real guns are back at the ranch because they're too dangerous in the studio. This is just a toy. And that satisfied him. Okay, I've got a real six-shooter.
All right. The heyday from the 20s and certainly all through World War II, television begins to come on the air in the 1950s. Some of these shows make the transition, and we might talk about those who could and those who didn't.
Yeah. Well, some did. Fibber McGee and Molly, for some reason, could not make the transition.
Jack Benny did.
Jack Benny did successfully. So did Eddie Cantor and Bob Hope, Red Skelton. Amos and Andy didn't work well on television. There were a number of shows like that. Oh, you just reminded me of another incident. Sam Spade, the great detective, he was at the microphone doing a skit with somebody. And then they played their part. And she was playing a dual role. And they did their little scene. And now he's ad-libbing and going on, carrying on the script. And his actress is late coming to the microphone. She's in a gun mall. She was a good girl. Now she's a gun mall. And he had to ad-lib and just keep going. Finally, she shows up on the mic. After the show, he said, what in the world are you doing? You were late to come back to the mic. She's doing a costume change. on radio. So it's hard to believe. But you also remind me of the rules of radio were so tough in those days. And on the Edgar Berg and Charlie McCarthy Sunday show, Don Ameche was the announcer, and they invited Mae West to do a skit one time. You know, she had quite a reputation. And they were a little nervous about it. And they did a scene in the Garden of Eden, and Don was Adam, and she was, of course, Eve. And she didn't say anything wrong. It was a biblical skit. There was nothing wrong. They checked the script. Well, she can't do anything to that. But her inflection, everything was sensuous. And people were so angry that they started calling. They said, this is a program for families and our little boys listening and all that. Well, I'll tell you what the penalty was. She was banned from NBC for 15 years. You could not even mention her name in a script for 15 years. Now, compare that with today. Maybe the Howard Stern Show, right? So things were different.
Yeah. Ozzie and Harriet transferred from radio to television.
They did a wonderful thing, yeah. And the two boys, Ricky and his brother, they were played by other children originally. And then eventually, when they got old enough, they grew up into the role.
Ricky and David.
Yeah.
Now, did Lucille Ball start on the radio or she always television?
She did some radio, but a very limited amount. But there were a lot of people came out of radio. I mentioned Richard Widmark before, and many people started their careers. Of course, voice was very important in those days, and if you had a good speaking voice. And the actor that was considered to have the best speaking voice in the history of radio was William Boyd, who became Hopalong Cassidy. I had another incident. Yeah, go ahead.
William Boyd actually had dated the mother of one of my growing up friends. And when Johnny was like his fifth birthday, this huge package arrived with Hopalong Cassidy bedspread, Hopalong Cassidy rugs, two sets of six shooters. So I got to wear one.
Oh boy!
Two. That was never one of my favorite shows, but I did like to get the. I got the.
I don't think young audiences today can appreciate how exciting radio was. Television just can't match it for the anticipation.
The Cisco Kid.
Yeah, exactly.
But do you realize a number of these very successful shows were ethnic?
Yes, Goldbergs. Or
the Cisco Kid, or the Lone Ranger, and
Life with Luigi, who was played by an Irishman, not exactly an Irish name.
Yeah,
you asked about my own career. Little thoughts have been popping up in me. Oh, I had an incident one time while I was working on this book over the years. A friend named Mary Jane Higby. She was on a show called When a Girl Marries, and she was a star actress on that show for 18 years. She was writing a book called Tune In Tomorrow. It's a very appropriate title, I thought, for history of soap opera. And we would exchange information back and forth. She'd say, do you know who the announcer was? And I'd call her back, so-and-so. Well, one day she called and said, Bill, who was the announcer on such and such a show? I said, I can't remember offhand, but I've got notes at home. And call my wife, introduce yourself to my wife, and just say that you need to know the name of the announcer because she needs it right now. It's getting close to press time. She said, okay. So I gave her the phone number. And my wife picks up the phone at home, unbeknownst to her. And this is Mary Jane Higby. I'm a friend of your husband's. Well, I'm probably in trouble already, right? But I'm writing a book, and your husband has some notes that I need to know about. And Rosemary said, oh, I don't know where he keeps his notes. That's his business. I have no idea. She said, oh, they're in a box under the bed. I had a lot of explaining to do that night. I think she accepted the story.
Well, when you were a young man, before you went to the other USC, what was your favorite radio program?
Well, one of my favorites I wasn't allowed to hear. It was called Lights Out. And it was really spooky stuff, and it came on about the time I was supposed to turn in. And they had terrible ordeals, operations. They would turn a man's body inside out and violent, terrible stuff. So my parents feared, naturally, that I would have nightmares, so I wasn't allowed. But my brothers could hear it, so I would tiptoe over to the door and listen and imagine I could hear what was going on. I really couldn't. But that was one of my very, very favorites.
Well, what was the one that had the creaking door.
Oh, Inner Sanctum. I've got that opening.
That was one I wasn't allowed to listen to, but my older brother could. I sneaked in and...
I got to know him. It was Raymond Edward Johnson was his name. And by the time I met him, he was helping me information about it. He was he had MS and he was on a wheelchair, but he still broadcast from his gurney, not a wheelchair, from his gurney. And he had that wonderful, mellifluous voice. And he was so helpful with the information. But it would start with, something like, "Good evening, friends. This is Raymond, your host, welcoming you into the Inner Sanctum." It was pretty spooky stuff.
And then you heard that creak.
The creaking door. Well, this is an interesting story. The door was before the program. Let me explain that. Hyman Brown was a producer. He did what they called the cheapies. He did low-budget program, but this time he hit the jackpot. And he was in the sound effects room, and he found this little door, and it was very creaky. And he says, that would be the great opening for a program. So he built Inner Sanctum around the sound effect. And that became the star of the show. One day he was wandering through the room, and the maintenance man was in there with his oil can, and he started to oil the door. He said, "Oh, no, don't touch that door." That would have ruined it completely. But the difficulty of doing the book with Raymond Edward Johnson, he was also Mandrake the Magician, and I couldn't find out who played his helper on the program, Narda, the princess. And I said, "Who was it?" And he says, "Oh, I can't remember her name." And I kept calling every few weeks, "Can you find out?" Finally, he remembered her name was Francesca Lenny. So I got to put that one name in. Nobody reading the book can appreciate how many hours I spent to find that one name. Nobody's going to say, "Oh, Bill, that was great that you found it. It was in there." But there was a lot of bulldogging to do.
Well, I just happened that clicked Mandrake the Magician, because there were also comic books that went along with these characters after they were developed.
That was wonderful when comic books came to – I think I have a section in there, comic strips going on radio. Dick Tracy, one of my favorites. And the beauty of radio, we haven't really mentioned that was you had to use your imagination. And I think it was so important in the development, children's development, which they don't get out of television. But you had to use your imagination, and that called the theater of the mind. I just came across, comic strips to radio. Here's some of the ones that came in on radio. Buck Rogers, one of the biggest of all. Flash Gordon, Buster Brown, Don Winslow of the Navy, the Gumps, the Nebs, Popeye the Sailor, Red Rider, I think we mentioned earlier, Superman. They were all...
What's the Gumps?
That was one of the most popular of all the comic strips in the 30s. Andy Gump was the scent, and his wife was Min, and he was always calling to her, "Oh, Min, oh, Min." He actually ran for president in 1936. Mm-hmm. He took it, of course, it's a joke, but he took it seriously, and he got many, many votes for president, Andy Gump. But that was one of the more popular comic strips. But that was another part of that era that was so wonderful. Besides radio, the comic strips, the movie serials, which don't exist today. It was just fantastic. And some of the commercials that you might remember. Pepsi-Cola, anybody remember how it goes? Hits the spot, 12 full ounces. What's the rest? That's a lot. All just four and nickel two. Pepsi-Cola is the rest. She's got it.
Well, Dr. Pepsi, 10, 2, and 4.
10, 2, and 4, Dr. Pepper. I used to think I should have three a day. I'd be really in good health if I had three of those a day, right? There was does everything. There was, this reminds me of Henry Morgan, who wrote the foreword for my book. He used to make fun of his sponsors, and one of them was Schick Razors. And their commercial was Schick Razors, push, pull, click, click, change blades that quick. So when he came to reading, he says, push, pull, click, click, change blades, nick, nick. And the sponsor didn't think that was humorous at all. So he got in a lot of trouble for that.
Bill, we've got to stop for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal. And I'm talking with Bill Owen and reminiscing about radio back before 1950 and Bill's career in broadcasting. When you talked about the Inner Sanctum, you did the opening.
Right.
And we talked about commercials. You didn't – the way it closed, and you might want to just read that closing for – because work the commercial into the closing as the door was creaking.
Inner Sanctum. Let's see. Where are we?
Page 119.
Oh, yeah. Now it's time to close the door of the Inner Sanctum. Until next week, when Palmolive Brushless and Palmolive Lather Shaving Cream bring you another Inner Sanctum mystery. Until then, good night. Pleasant dreams. Of course, that gave us chills. He didn't really want us to have pleasant dreams, I don't think.
Squeak. The door squeaked.
Oh, that was fantastic. We should talk about Orson Welles. He was he was an egomaniac, of course, but a wonderful, wonderful actor. And he had a program October 30th, 1938, almost Halloween.
The War of the Worlds.
The War of the Worlds. And that is so – and most of you have heard of it, and the recordings are extant. You can get those if you want to listen to them. But what happened was he had a program called the Mercury Theater in the Air, and he was competing with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy on Sunday nights. That's pretty awesome to try to – everybody in America was listening to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
And Mortimer Sturt.
And Mortimer Sturt, Ken. And Effie Clinker, a third one, yeah. So anyhow, he's on CBS trying to dent their ratings. And he put the traditional apology at the beginning. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not a true story. This is pure fiction, so on. But he knew that nobody was listening to that. They're already listening to Charlie McCarthy. So he got that in, the legal thing, and then started to play music from a hotel. And then all of a sudden, the announcer breaks in and says, there are reports of some little green men in New Jersey that are advancing on Manhattan. And people, at that point, he timed it so that it was the first commercial on Edgar Bergen. And so he's got an audience all of a sudden. And people hear that, wow, what's this? And they start calling their neighbors. Have you turn on your radio, turn on CBS. They didn't think that all the stations would have it. It was legitimate. But they said, turn to CBS, and there's an invasion going on Mars. And it worked. It scared people to death. It was just the people in New York would call their friends in Boston and say, I can see the fires burning in New York. You know, it's awful. The whole East Coast is going up in flames. And when it was finally over, there was such a to-do about it that the police were waiting for Orson Welles. And he was booked and arrested and charged with inciting a riot. And from then on, they had to have a federal rule that you could never, never make people think it was something true that was not actually happening. So he got in a whale of trouble. But it's one of the probably biggest milestones in the history of radio.
Well, and of course, Welles had a tremendous following.
Oh,
his show
absolutely.
Did. Almost 10 years later, right after World War II, an incident happened here in South Carolina in Batesburg where a young black enlisted man going home was taken off a Greyhound bus, beaten by the local sheriff, and blinded. And Welles made that a cause célèbre for almost a month, raising money for this young Army veteran. So he didn't mind stepping into things.
He made his mark. That's incredible.
I hate to say this, but Alfred is saying, it's time for us to wrap this up. But before we do, I think we have any questions from the audience, and we're just going, everybody gets a shot to ask. All right, sir?
I was going to ask about the role radio played in the United States with the public during World War II.
Yeah, that's a great question, because until then, news was not really an important staple in radio. They would often have a little local newscast in the morning, the local station, and at night, at 10 o'clock at night, sometimes the networks would have a 15-minute wrap-up. Nothing during the day. And during the war, CBS was the first. They started putting on little 5-minute newscasts at the end of the show. They would cut the shows to 25 minutes and have a little sum-up of the battle activity and so on. And gradually, it became more and more important. And after a while, so many commentators emerged, like Gabriel Heater. He was every household in America would listen to Gabriel. He would say, there's good news tonight, and that encouraged people.
Edward R. Murrow.
He was reporting live from London with the bombs falling. He was incredible. And then H.V. Kaltenborn. But that was exactly right. News and never left. From then it became the heart of radio, actually.
Well, Bill, I hate to say it. Alfred not just giving me the wind-up sign. He's giving the time to cut off the discussion. As much as fun as we're having here with the audience. And I want to thank you, Bill Owen, for being with us today on The Journal to talk about radio and the shows of yesteryear.
Well, it was an era never to be forgotten, and I'm so happy that I was able to help preserve the memories of that wonderful era.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I surely did. It took me back to my childhood, listening to shows that were permissible for me, like Big John and Sparky on Saturday morning, but then also tiptoeing to my older brother's bedroom and things like the Scarlet Pimpernel, which were for older listeners. It was an age when your imagination could roam from 17th century England to the Great Plains of the American West to the frozen North and Sergeant King of the Yukon. Gosh, it was quite a different world. Today's show brought back a lot of memories, not just for me, but also a studio audience. All of this is part of our country's history, but also for those of us in the South for whom the radio was a link to the outside world. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.